My mother was quite a moralist. She cared a lot about how things were done. And I disagreed with her on that, of course, as a teenager. But she died when I was about 23. And I always have kept the legacy of her feeling that things were important, that it is important what you do. Not that I inherited her specific morality around things, but that I realized that the life is important and what you do is important. It's not something to take too lightly.
Well, that's quite a learning.
It was a great learning, and it's kept me, I don't know, maybe interested in everything that's happening all my life, really. And the other thing is too that when your mother dies when you're young, you maybe think more about Mother Earth and Mother Universe than you would otherwise. I don't know. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, it surely shifts things without your mother being there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the video of your life, A Giving for Giving, that's the title of it, is it not?
Yeah.
Is wonderful. And this hour-long video, and has wonderful photographs of your growing up years and your family, and continues on as you, with your mothering your own beautiful little children. You know, it's quite a remarkable thing that you have done, giving away your money. And I'm wondering where this idea of giving came to you.
Well, it actually came from the theory that I was developing about the gift economy, as well as, I guess, my family had a foundation, and they, my father and my mother and so on, they participated in a foundation that they had created and one that my grandparents had created. But more than that, it was just the theory of the thing that helped me become empowered enough to do it myself in a different way, not through just traditional foundation, but doing it for social change and for women. I can tell you the story about how I began to think along these lines. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I had money and other people didn't, and I always wondered why that was, and how could some people be rich and other people be poor? And, you know, a number of explanations were given to me, such as rich people are smart and poor people are not, or rich people are industrious and poor people are lazy, and that kind of thing, which didn't satisfy me at all, because I knew plenty of smart and industrious poor people. Mm-hmm. But finally, I met the Italian philosopher who I later married, and he told me that poor people are poor because rich people are rich. That is, there's a transfer of wealth going on between one and the other. And that finally made sense to me. As my theory has developed, I have begun to consider that a gift that poor people are giving to rich people, but that I'm getting ahead of myself on that. After I got married to this Italian philosopher, he got invited to go to Bologna to talk about starting a new academic journal together with some other people, and they were going to apply Marx's analysis of the commodity and money to language. And that idea totally enthralled me. I was just bowled over by what they said. I had one of those aha moments when, you know, you think you can understand everything. But then I, of course, lost all of the particulars of that, or almost all of them. My husband did develop a theory of language as based on exchange, or he wrote a book called Language as Labor and Trade. It was about applying the market to language, or language to the market. But I had little children. They were not exchanging, and they were too little to understand money, and yet they were speaking, so language had to come before exchange, I believed, and it was something else. Couldn't be the market that it came from. And so for years I thought about this and worked on it, and then it occurred to me that communication and exchange are two different things, although we usually put them together, and that communication is actually based on gift giving. That is, giving to satisfy the communicative needs of the other person, not of your communicative needs, of the other person, to put that person in relation to something that's in your environment or the world around you, or your thoughts or whatever it may be. Looking at communication as gift giving gave me the impetus to look at the gift giving that was going on in indigenous societies, which were so-called pre-capitalist or pre-market societies. And I could see, of course, in those societies, people certainly were talking, but they didn't have markets. That they had maybe gifting circles, but the market itself is not a necessary part of human life. It's something that we've invented to distribute goods, and really we're distributing goods very badly through the market, because we now have 2% of the population of the world own 50% of the wealth. But we don't have to do things that way. We don't have to use the market to distribute our goods. We could distribute them directly, and psychologically it's so much better for us to give and receive directly rather than exchanging everything and trying to profit from it. So as I began to understand this and look at indigenous societies, I became a feminist around that time, which I guess was around 1978, the same year I got a divorce as well. And the consciousness-raising group that I was in discussed women's housework and how that was free, and I realized it's a huge gift that women are giving to the market economy.
Absolutely. But
then realizing that housework is such a huge gift to the market, I was beginning to realize all of the other kinds of free gifts that are being given in society all the time that we don't really look at. And also, we don't usually look at mothering as having anything to do with communication. But I think it's a unilateral gift. It's gift giving directly to satisfy needs. That is the basic human logic, the basic human interaction. And that is what creates bonds among people, because the giver gives to somebody, they have to see what the need is and make something or produce something to satisfy that need. The point of the interaction is the well-being of the other person. Mm-hmm. So the person who is the giver has to recognize the receiver. And the receiver is not passive, but has to be able to use whatever is given to her in a creative way. The child has to be able to swallow the food and digest it, and her body has to function in order to allow that gift to come to fruition. The receiver often also recognizes the giver as the source of the gift. She doesn't have to. It doesn't necessarily become some kind of an exchange. It's just that she responds. And there has been a lot of discussion of gift-giving in the last 10 or 20 years by a number of academics. There's the Derrida talked a lot about gift-giving. He had a criticism. He thought that there couldn't be unilateral gift-giving because it's almost always recognized. As soon as the gift is recognized as a gift, he thought that was a payoff to the giver. And my response to that is that if everyone were doing gift giving, it wouldn't be anything special to do it. It would be, you wouldn't get any special recognition for doing it. It's the odd situation that we've created by having the market be the context for all of our actions that makes gift giving unusual and strange. And so it makes it a special thing to give. And then you get recognized for that, and that turns it into an exchange. But if everyone were doing it, then it wouldn't be there wouldn't be any particular recognition.
Right.
And I have to say that that often happens with mothers, because mothers are doing all this giving all the time, and nobody's recognizing them.
That's true. So, it's not even noticed.
So it kind of proves my point, I think, that there is actually a lot of hidden unilateral gift giving going on, especially by women in taking care of everybody.
That's right. And you think of, in a family that if you have siblings, even as adults, that you would help each other, and there isn't a price tag attached to it. It's just how you live.
That's right. That's right. But we often, since we live in this market economy, we are sort of magnetized into the values of the market. And we believe that only if we're paid for something is it worth anything. Even among brothers and sisters, that can happen. It doesn't always.
I'm sure.
It can happen that way. And even between married people or partners and so forth, I washed the dishes tonight. Now you have to wash the dishes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's a sort of, the other person isn't giving enough and that kind of thing that really ruins the relationship. But we don't realize that gift giving is itself a positive thing, and we've learned to discredit it as we discredit women. I mean, it's all part of a sort of a general misogyny from thousands of years,
right,
that is still weighing on us.
You write that the mechanism of the market, in a self-confirming game of smoke and mirrors, makes it appear that it is the source of wealth and the distributor of need-satisfying goods. However, it is the flow of unilateral gifts from the many to the few that is actually creating that captured abundance. The free portion of cheap labor of the many, the low-cost raw materials, and the margins caused by level of life in different areas function to subsidize the market and create the profit which motivates it. In fact, the market is actually parasitic on the gifts of the many. It is the invisibility of the flow of gifts and the ostentation, the visibility of those who reap advantages, which make it appear that the market is a source of good for all. Reciprocal gift exchange in this situation, the exchange of favors, serves to solidify a capitalist class community. Festivals and monetary gifts circulate to create networks and dependencies in mafia-like corporate cultures for groups like Enron, but also for the political, military, industrial elites. Elections are financed in this way, and politicians' dependence on gifts that they must later reciprocate seems to be the normal way for democracy to function. Moreover, the values of patriarchy inform the exchange economy, the drive to accumulate and dominate, independence, indifference to the needs of others, competitiveness serve the market, motivating it to such an extent that we should call the system we live in patriarchal capitalism, or with a slightly different emphasis, capitalist patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if we can understand that capitalism is patriarchal, we can unite the feminist movement in a more radical criticism, both of patriarchy and of capitalism. We really have to create a different kind of economy and a way where needs can get satisfied rather than greed being satisfied. If we don't do that, we are going to totally destroy the earth and not have any gift giving possible for the future generations. So it may seem unrealistic to think that we could create an economy based on mothering, but we need to do that because we are actually all human beings are actually basically maternal. That is why I talk about homo donans instead of homo sapiens, homo donans as the gift-giving being rather than homo sapiens just as the knowing being. Because you, even when you're a child, you have to be given to before you can know. And we're all in receivership of the gifts of the earth and of our environment. All of our perceptions come to us free from the world around us. And if we project the mother onto the world around us instead of some dead objectivity, then we can live in gratitude for what we are given rather than destroying nature as we're doing. I think really it is the market is a psychological tool that we've created that we are hurting ourselves with and transforming ourselves into beings that are destructive, destroying the earth and each other.
That's right. You also write that men can perform the mothering role as well, but their gender identity, at least in male-dominant Euro-America, is usually constructed in opposition to gift-giving mothering. In this early construction, which I call masculation, boys give up the prototype of the gift-giving mother for their human identity and replace it with the prototype of the dominant father. In psychology, of course, you have to separate from the mother. There's all of this talk, which obviously was unheard of in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's nonsense.
Exactly. We need to be independent to some extent, and mothers can help by furthering that independence. A mother that would not let her child be independent enough to walk would be a bad mother. She wouldn't be satisfying that need. And beyond that, in many other aspects of life, everyone needs to be independent. But that doesn't mean they have to give up the maternal values, that is, the values of care of others. And that is just what has happened in this masculation process. The boy feels like he has to be the opposite, because he's in an opposite gender, of his gift-giving mother, and that gift-giving, that nurturing, seems to be the main thing about mothers to little children, obviously, because that's the biggest part of their lives. So they have to, the boys have to become something other than the mother.
They have to close down their hearts, which is just awful.
Yeah, and one of the things they do, I think, is that they replace this gift-giving with hitting. That is, gift-giving touches the other person and establishes a relationship with the other person. But hitting also touches the other person and establishes a relationship, but one of domination rather than one of mutuality and trust.
Yes.
Anyway, I think that this hitting that little boys develop instead of giving and instead of nurturing, then itself mushrooms into wars, into adult violence. Mm. We have a masculine identity or a masculated identity, which is warlike in our society. Not all men are like that. It doesn't infect all men equally, but this is a sort of a cultural ideal of this warlike male. And our president, our vice presidents and so forth are acting out an agenda that has to do with that and with being the one at the top, that is being the model, of the non-giving human, the one that's imposing and dominating. We could get around that. I think it is something that is emphasized and made worse by the market, because the market is also based on a one-to-many interaction with money being the one and the commodities being the many.
Oh, yes. And, greed is
seems to reign. People want to possess
yes.
the one and be the one at the top. That's why I call it patriarchal capitalism, is that rush to the top.
Yes.
Trying to.
One of my feelings has been that because little boys are in so many ways instructed not to feel, not to let their feelings show, not to need, and so in a way it means not to love.
Right.
And when you can't have love, then money is the only thing that's left.
Right.
And it seems to me that's exactly what we are seeing in our world culture.
But the thing is that if you're taught not to feel, then you don't respond to the needs of other people.
That's
and so
right.
you can't do the gift giving.
That's right. You don't feel your own pain. You don't feel others' pain. That's right.
That keeps you from having to do that gift giving interaction.
You write in again in your book Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange, in the section Knowledge of the Heart. This book is wonderful, and that it's available to anyone who visits your website is a wonderful gift for us all, along with all your other work. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
But you write, humans are basically loving beings. Our social structures and the logic of exchange are patriarchal distortions of love. The sharing and caring which we experience in the original mother-child relation are often the only experience of free love we have, and they become the model for us for the rest of our lives. This is the reason early childhood is so important for our psychology. All the rest of our lives, we have to deal with the various distortions and blockages of love. Our nostalgia for childhood, even for the womb, is nostalgic for a primary period of health which has never returned because there is no social or economic structure that permits it. Our independence is so distorted that we belittle dependence instead of honoring it. We insist on standing alone, and yet we are a mass of individuals crying to be touched, fed, caressed, supported.
That was Genevieve Vaughan with her angle on the importance of a gift economy. Of course, she's coming from somewhere very different than most people who are addressing this topic, as somebody who's spent decades promoting a gift economy. A more common way to understand the importance of the gift economy is to look at the existing economy and notice that because it assumes exponential growth of goods and services and it doesn't consider the implications for the biosphere of provision of those services, that it's unsustainable. Another way to approach the same conclusion, I think, is to look at levels of stress and mental health. The WHO ranks depression as the number one cause of disability worldwide, and it's still growing, which should give us some food for thought. It's a relevant riposte to people who talk about life getting better and better. This, as I see it, has got to be some indicator that we're going in the wrong direction. As we've covered a lot on the show, there's any number of indicators from an ecological perspective that the way the planet is being treated is unsustainable. Now, within the capitalist framework, there doesn't appear to a lot of people to be a lot of alternatives. People have to put bread on the table. People feel powerless to change the system. I conclude from this that a change is coming, and what's needed is a way that people can coordinate their actions and their feelings. Money, on one level, allows people to coordinate their actions. One of the breakthroughs of Adam Smith was that the system could have an intelligence greater than the sum of its parts. When people were behaving in their narrow self-interest, then nevertheless worthwhile purposes would be served. And for some of human history, that's an important perspective on the market system. What we now call the market, however, bears little resemblance to the traditional market in which people knew each other, in which social factors could be relied upon to regulate people's behavior. What we now have in the market is something of a religion. Recalling George Lakoff's strict father model, there are people out there who earnestly believe that the market is a regulator of discipline, that people who have a lot of money, however they got that money, therefore are worthy people whose position in society needs to be respected. And you can talk to these people about regulatory capture. You can talk to them about all the wicked ways there are of making money in this world, and they're not interested because they've decided that money measures morality, which seems like an insane set of perspectives to a lot of us. However, if we're within the market framework and we're going along with the market framework, then we're honoring those perspectives. We're going to work for whoever's got money. Now, have we collectively got what it takes to invent a new system, a new framework? Can we get out of this 12 shovels madness, which pitches all against all, or to be exact, pitches everybody who's short of money against everybody else who is short of money, while a small group who control the system regulate it to keep themselves out of trouble? They have an inordinate influence over the media in particular, but generally over a lot of what goes on in the world. Have we got what it takes to come up with a new system, one that doesn't enshrine self-interest as the highest good, one that doesn't encourage people to be selfish? Well, this is what Jeremy Rifkin, our last speaker today, will be talking about. Our last speaker, Jeremy Rifkin, is putting forward a positive vision of how people might work together, and it's coming from a very different perspective from Genevieve Vaughan. Jeremy Rifkin has worked a lot in business. Check out his bio. But I think it's got a lot in common with Genevieve Vaughan's and Alfie Cohn's ideas, in that he is not taking a pessimistic view of what it means to be human, and he's looking at all the negativity and the frustration and the negatives that go on in this world as a sign that we are living the wrong way, that human beings should not be doing this, that a positive vision of the future is possible. His new book, which puts this forward, is called Empathic Civilization. He's speaking here in Rotterdam last December. He was keynote speaker at the Global Urban Summit, and this is what he had to say.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to start off with a very sober note. In 2007, we had a turning point for the human race. For the first time in our 175,000 years on this planet, we became Homo urbanus. More people now live in urban areas than rural areas. One of the great turning points in history. Last month, the Financial Times ran a small article. It did not register on the radar screen. Perhaps the most important piece of information we've ever had, and we all missed it. Our scientists report that within 30 years from now, we are likely to see open waters in the Arctic across the summer. We haven't seen that reality in millions and millions and millions of years on this little planet. And Homo sapiens, again, have been here only 175,000 years. We're the youngest species on the block. As my wife says, we're not grasping the enormity of this moment. You are. You're the front line. But your fellow citizens are asleep. That's why it's so frustrating for you every day when you get to the office. You see the reality of this and the time we have left. 2 weeks ago, the United Nations FAO met in Rome on an emergency meeting They now report we have 1 billion people, 1 billion people going to bed hungry. That's 1 out of 7 human beings. And our anthropologists tell us never before in history has 1 out of 7 human beings gone to bed without the to feed themselves. And if our climate change models are correct, as climate change continues to deteriorate the conditions of the planet, more floods, more droughts, more wildfires, our yields are going to go down, and we could see a collapse of agriculture by 2030 because of climate change. If agriculture collapses, urban civilization goes down. As context, let me introduce an anecdote because I think it's instructive of the challenges we all face in urban civilization. When Chancellor Merkel became Chancellor of Germany the first time around, she asked me to come to Berlin in the first few weeks to help her government address the question, how do we grow the German economy in the 21st century? Interesting question. When I got to Berlin, the first question I asked the Chancellor is, Madam Chancellor, how do we grow the German economy or the EU economy or the global economy in the last stages of a great energy era? This is what we're not talking about, a G20, G7, or G2. We are in the sunset of one of the great energy revolutions in all of history. Coal, oil, natural gas, tar sand, heavy oil, shale, uranium. Is there anyone here in this room, anyone that thinks we're in the sunrise of these energies? Of course not. Sunsets take a while. We're going to be in this very dangerous twilight period for the next several decades. But what is becoming increasingly clear in the business community and in our great cities is that the problems attendant to these conventional energies are now overwhelming the benefits we get from them. Do we have any engineers here today? Engineers. You know, in the final analysis, we never escape the second law of thermodynamics. We are paying the entropy bill. This is not a metaphor. We took the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age, we dug them up, we created one of the great short-lived civilizations in history. Now that spent CO2, that is entropy, it's clogging the biosphere, and we're not getting enough of the solar radiation back out of the Earth. That's as simple and profound as that. That's the problem. So what do we do? Because it is all about fossil fuels. We grow our food and petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides for the most part. All of the construction materials of our civilization are based on the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age, from cement to plastic. Almost all of our pharmaceutical products are fossil fuel-based. Most of the fiber for our clothes and materials are fossil fuel-based. Our power, transport, heat, light, logistics, supply chain, it's all built off the burial grounds, the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age. And now in this sunset, this twilight period, we have three crises. They are feeding off each other. They put us in the middle of a perfect storm. And the great cities of the world are here this afternoon to try to figure out how to get through the eye of the storm to calm waters quickly. Crisis number one, the global economic meltdown. Crisis number two, the global energy crisis. Crisis number three, the real-time impacts of climate change on agriculture already in 2009. That's the storm. Crisis one, let me say I disagree with my colleagues, many of them. This is not simply an economic crisis, this meltdown, or a financial crisis, or a credit crisis, or simply a crisis of the deregulation of the market. That's the echo. The earthquake is something different. And unless we understand the difference between the earthquake and the echo, we can't get to a post-carbon era. Here's the earthquake. The second industrial revolution based on centralized electrification, oil, the introduction of the internal combustion engine, the auto culture, the great interstate highway infrastructures, suburban rollout and construction, travel and tourism, that massive juggernaut which came together between 1900 and 1929 as a juvenile infrastructure. Then we had a depression and war, and then the mature infrastructure with the interstate, suburban rollout, tourism, it all matured between the 1950s and it peaked in the 1980s in my country, 1988. It peaked in Europe 10 years later. And in 1988, after we overbuilt the suburban rollout from the auto age, we went into a big recession. Some of you older folks remember, a housing and retail commercial recession. How did we get out of that recession in 91? Because that is the key to understanding the economic meltdown today. We didn't have a third industrial revolution in place in 91 to take up the tremendous multiplier effect of the auto age and suburban rollout. So in lieu of a third industrial revolution, and I should say the ICT revolution was boutique. It hadn't found its gate. It's only doing this right now, as we'll talk about later. So in lieu of a third industrial revolution, how did we regrow the economy? We began to live off the savings of 50 years of the second industrial revolution from 1950 to 1988. We built globalization on American purchasing power, and American purchasing power was built on the savings of the productivity and technology of an industrial revolution that had peaked in the late 80s. We extended a credit card debt so we could move the economy. We began to deplete family savings, so we had purchasing power, and we began to grow globalization. It was all built on a past revolution, not on new technology and productivity. After we maxed out our credit cards, because wages had been stagnant since the auto age peaked in the 80s, then we went to bizarre mortgage instruments with our homes, but it wasn't based on new prosperity, it was based on eating up old savings and going into debt. Then that collapsed. The average family savings rate in my country in 1991 was 9%. For the last 3 years, it was negative, and we have a new term called negative income, which is an oxymoron. We spend more than we make. How bad is it? President Obama's bailout program is $2 trillion. Would you like to know what the total accumulated household debt in the United States is this afternoon? You ready? $14 trillion. We're broke. Unemployment's 10.2%, but even the U.S. Labor Department acknowledges that if you add the marginally attached workers who are only working a couple hours a week now, and then everyone else who gave up looking for work and is not counted, we have 18.2% unemployment, $14 trillion in debt. Does anyone think we're going to come back soon? 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? We are living in an second industrial revolution that's old and senescent. The technologies, the infrastructure, from the internal combustion engine to an old servo mechanical electrical grid to an old suburban rollout, it's all on life support based on energies that are sunsetting. How do we regrow the economy in any way on a dead corpse? Look around Rotterdam and Amsterdam and New York, and I was just in Athens. You can smell this is not new. And don't kid yourself. Go to China and you see the new buildings. That's still the old infrastructure and the old architecture and the old technology by and large. So number one, we have an economic meltdown. It's based on an energy regime that's sunsetting, and all the technology and infrastructure built from it are on life support. Number two, the second assumption of globalization, cheap energy. We can move our capital to cheap labor markets in Asia. Let them make the food, let them make the finished goods, then ship it back because energy is cheap. It's a commodity. Then a curious thing happened. When oil went over 80 a barrel, and keep that number in mind, every day you open up the paper and look to see where oil is. It's now back at 80. That's the key. When oil goes over 80 a barrel, inflation starts to rear up across the entire supply chain and logistics of the planet because everything's made from fossil fuels or moved by fossil fuels. When oil hit $147 a barrel in July of 2008, that was the earthquake. The entire economic engine of globalization turned off. Remember, purchasing power plummeted. Inflation was too high. There were food riots in 30 countries. You couldn't even afford gasoline. And the purchasing power plummeted. The economic engine turned off. That's what I call peak globalization. We now know the outer wall of what we can do based on fossil fuels and the technologies built from them. The echo was 60 days later when the financial and credit market could no longer maintain the pretense of living off an old industrial revolution. And I have to tell you that heads of state, including the ones I advise, have not yet gotten this. A few have, but not in Washington. The reason we hit peak globalization at $147 a barrel is because of peak oil per capita. Do not confuse this with peak oil production. They're two different things. I know you all know about peak oil production. That's when half the world's oil reserves are used up on the classic Hubert bell curve in geology. When half the oil is used up, it's over, because once you go on the other side of that bell curve, you can't afford the price. When do we have global peak oil production? There's a controversy, but it's narrowing every year. Back in 2000, the IEA, they were always the optimists until recently, International Energy Agency said at a 2% growth rate in consumption of oil, this was conservative because China and India weren't in the game yet, we peak around 2035. But in the last 8 or 9 years, the great geologists in the world, using new computer simulation studies, they're looking at the gas and oil reserve figures again, they're factoring in dramatic new oil discoveries that we don't even know about. South Africa, West Africa, South America, the Arctic. They're even factoring in 90% efficiency in getting the remaining oil and gas out. Pretty optimistic. And they're saying by their studies, we're going to peak between 2010 and 2020. Simmons, you know, the Aramco former consultant, said we peaked last year. As you know, up here in this part of the world, the North Sea's peaked already. Mexico peaks next year. Russia peaks shortly thereafter, so their geopolitical moment for oil and gas is short-lived. I don't know who's right. It's interesting that the IEA is now have a new forecast out saying supply crunch 2014. I don't know who's right, the pessimist, the optimist. It really doesn't make any difference anymore, does it? They're arguing now about 10 or 15 or 20 years. Do we peak between 2010 and 2010 and 20, the pessimist? 2020, maybe 2030, the optimist? Short time to rethink the entire energy of civilization, all the materials based on it, and create a new economy. And by the way, as you know, there's plenty of other fossil fuels. Tar sands in Canada, heavy oil in Venezuela, shale, but they're dirtier, they emit more CO2, and we never factored them in to our climate change models. The reason we hit peak globalization, though, last summer is peak oil per capita. That occurred in 1979 at the height of the auto age. If you distributed all the oil reserves that we knew we had then to every human being living at that point, that's the most you could get per person. We found more oil in the last 30 years, but population rose quicker. So you see where I'm going. When China and India made a massive bid to bring one-third of the human race into a second industrial revolution structure, the demand pressure on the oil was so great that after 80 a barrel, inflation goes up. At 147 a barrel, the engine turns off. Now, you notice the economy's regrowing now slightly because we're replenishing inventories. But as soon as we began to do it, oil shot back to 80 a barrel. What I'm telling you, it's a rubber band. Every time we try to get up, we're going to short circuit at 147 and go right back down. This is the reality we have to understand. This is the earthquake. The financial meltdown is the echo. Finally, the real-time impacts of climate change on agriculture. How bad is it? It is much worse than the public's being told. You know how bad it is because you're spending every day on it. I was in Paris with President Chirac in 2007 when the fourth assessment report of the UN panel on climate change was put out in Paris. We had world leaders there, and I have to say, we were all taken aback because we had all gotten it wrong. I'm going to tell you, I got it wrong. My colleagues got it wrong. There may be a few of you very old people who suffered through a book I wrote in 1980 called Entropy. It was the first book on climate change. I have to tell you now, I got it wrong. We all continued to underestimate the acceleration of climate change because we couldn't imagine the feedback loops until after they happened. It's the feedback loops that keep coming back to kick us. How bad is the acceleration? If you look at the 2001 UN report and compare it to 2007, it's terrifying because in 2001, we didn't have a lot of the feedbacks in yet. The model showed that our great glaciers on the mountain ranges would disappear sometime in the 22nd century, giving us a little time. 2007 UN climate change report, the glaciers are disappearing in real time across the world from the Alps to the Andes in the first 40 years of this century, and we're going to lose up to 60% of those glaciers by mid-century. This isn't about skiing at Davos. One out of every six human beings relies totally on those glaciers every year for their irrigation, sanitation, and hygiene, everything. How do we repopulate one-sixth of the world's population in 40 years? And that's just the beginning of the feedback loops. The third report in 2007 of the UN said, look to the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf Stream, 22nd century, temperature of the Earth heats, the Gulf Stream heats, more Category 3s, Category 4s, Category 5 hurricanes. The fourth report, 2007, Katrina and Rita, Gustav and Ike, put us in real-time climate change. We've doubled the intensity of hurricanes in 30 years. We're here, 100 years earlier. It's not academic. If you have friends or relatives who live in the United States from Florida to Texas, on the opening day of hurricane season, and from then on, they turn on the Weather Channel every single morning, and they cross their fingers another hurricane is not brewing in the Atlantic. Those four hurricanes alone cost us over $100 billion, and this is just 2009. What about 2010, 2020, 2030? And finally, of course, the third report said, look to the Arctic, early warning system, 22nd century, maybe ocean waters all open. The fourth report, 2007, the polar bears are drowning now in real time. And we've had open waters in August for 3 years in the Arctic. You can kayak into the Arctic in August. That's just amazing. So how bad is it? The UN report in 2007 says 3 degrees Celsius rise is a middle scenario. Could go higher. Now that's looking optimistic, I'm sure, to folks in this room. But to put this in perspective, if we only go up 3 degrees in the century of you and your children, that takes us back to the temperature on this little planet 3 million years ago in the Pliocene. Different flora and fauna, but here's the most important thing to spread to your friends. It's all about the hydrological cycle. That's what's never explained. It's all about the cycle of water. For every 1 degree Celsius that the planet's temperature rises, the atmosphere absorbs 7% more precipitation and sucks it up from the ground. That means much more violent downburst of rain, more drought, and longer periods without rain. The entire ecosystems of this biosphere developed over eons of time for a different hydrological cycle. They can't catch up to this. 3 degrees, that's a big change in the water. If we go 2 to 3 degrees, now I advise the European Union, everyone's going to Copenhagen this next week, and we are hoping that the world would mitigate to CO2 so we only go up 2 degrees. And nobody wants to play, including the Obama administration. Understand, I voted for President Obama, but please understand what he and his political party have done. In the U.S. House of Representatives, and this party did it, and he did not say a thing. They passed a bill in the House that would cut global warming emissions by 17% by 2020. And that doesn't sound bad, because the EU is 20% cut. But the U.S. figures are based on 2005 emissions. The EU is based on 1990 emissions. So the real cut in the U.S. under President Obama's leadership, he didn't even argue it out, is a 4% cut in global warming gases by 2020. My friends, that's lower than developing countries. He needs to get off the world stage, or he needs to stand up and be counted. So if we go 2 to 3 degrees, our UN climate panel report says we risk between, on the low end, 25% of all plant and animal species extinct. On the high end, 70% of all the life on this planet that's so far been assessed extinct, maybe by the end of the century. That's a wipeout. We've only had 5 waves of biological extinction in the last 450 million years in the geological record, 4 wipeouts. Every time we had a mass extinction, it took 10 million years to recover the biodiversity we lost. We're not grasping this. It's maybe too enormous. It's eluding us. It's not even the top 20 issues in American public. The EU is an exception in terms of public opinion. But the EU also is going to have to be the flagship. If the EU is not the flagship, I don't know where it's going to come from. It's about feedback loops. We had permafrost in the fourth assessment report in Siberia, but there were no studies in, so it wasn't in the models. Just to give you one feedback, if you've traveled to Siberia, it's permafrost across the ground in an area the size of France and Germany. And underneath that permafrost is a ticking time bomb. It's the entire carbon deposits of the pre-ice age, because Siberia was a teeming grassland full of animal and plant life. And when the temperature tips on the planet, it tips really quick. There's a tipping point on the biochemistry. For example, between the last ice age and today, 1/3 of all the temperature change we've had occurred in 10 years during the Younger Dryas period. Massive extinction. So in Siberia, that happened too. Tipping point in the temperature, plant and animal life captured under the frost. And now the permafrost is melting. And there's more carbon down there under the ground than in all the tropical rainforests put together in the world. And it's coming up CO2. And during at the lake beds, it's coming up methane, which is 22 times more potent than CO2. And the journal Nature a few months ago said in the last 12 months since they reported the ice melt, it's accelerating 6 times faster than 12 months ago. This is just one feedback loop. James Hansen is the chief climatologist for the United States government. He's the head of the Goddard, NASA Goddard Space Institute. He threw us another curve in Brussels because we are hoping to tell the world mitigated 450 parts carbon per million and maybe we'll only go up 2 degrees. Then James Hansen and his team went down under the oceans and they looked at the core samples from the geological record and they said to Brussels, you've got the figures wrong. You're wrong. If you mitigated 450 parts carbon per million, remember, we haven't even seen 250 parts per million until the industrial age. His numbers show we go up, and listen to this, every parent in this room and every would-be young person is going to be a parent. We go up 6 degrees Celsius in this century. And this is a quote from our chief climatologist, Jim Hansen. The end of human civilization as we've come to know it. I hope he's wrong. I really do hope they're all wrong. Now look at all the younger people here. You'll be here to see this. This is a singular moment in our history. If they're right, and I suspect they're underestimating the speed, we may be determining the fate of our species in the next 3 to 5 decades. That's why all of you are here. You're the front line. You're trying to inform the world and move the world quickly. To do that, we're going to need a few things. First, we're going to need a new economic game plan, a new economic vision that can move quickly into practice. None of that's at Copenhagen. Two, we're going to need a new story for the human race, a new narrative that gets us to global consciousness quick enough to put the new plan in place. Three, everyone's going to have to be on the same page for 5 generations. Daunting task. We need a new economic game plan that might be powerful enough to address the enormity of this triple threat. The global economic meltdown, second industrial revolution and life support, traditional energy sunsetting. Global peak globalization at 147 a barrel, the energy crisis, and the real-time impacts now of climate change on agriculture and infrastructure. What do we do? First, we ask this question. When do the great economic revolutions in history occur? We need a new one, correct? This is what all your sessions have been about in the last 2 days. The first thing to ask in the first session is, how do the great economic revolutions occur in history? They occur when two things happen. First, we humans change the way we organize energy on the earth, and we have frequently changed our energy regimes. That's number one. Secondly, equally important, we change the way we communicate to manage the new energy revolutions. It is when communication revolutions converge with energy revolutions, when they come together, those are the pivotal points in history. They change the human equation for long periods of time. They change gestalt, as the Germans say. They change temporal spatial footprint. They actually change consciousness and the wiring of the brain. Communication energy revolutions. That's the changes in history. I'll give you an example. Some of you are fortunate to study cultural anthropology at the university. You read about the Sumerians in Mesopotamia. Why do we care about them? They launched civilization in ancient Iraq. They did it by capturing the sun, the energy of the sun in photosynthesis. And the stored grain, barley and wheat, that stored sunlight in the grain was stored energy like fossil fuels. They created the first great hydraulic agricultural civilizations. It was complicated. Before that time, people lived in small pastoral and horticultural units of a couple of hundred people in a village. All of a sudden, they had to indenture thousands of men to build those canals. Think of the logistics of this. That was the first machine, the mega human machine, as Lewis Mumford would say. Then they had to create craft skills to build the dikes and the mechanics of a hydraulic system. They had to set up the royal granaries, the royal roads, and the distribution system for civilization. They had to create urban life. It required a communication revolution to manage the new energy regime for hydraulic agriculture. and they invented cuneiform writing. And what is so interesting is everywhere we had these great hydraulic civilizations invented in the Middle East, the Indus Valley of India, the Yangtze in China, and even Mexico, independently, humans come up with some form of writing to manage hydraulic agriculture. That's amazing. 10,000-year multiplier effect, the agricultural age, and consciousness went from mythological to theological and from animism to monotheism. Changed the world. Stay with me, 19th century. Another convergence of communication and energy. The print press had been around since Gutenberg. The Chinese and Koreans actually had it even earlier. But it didn't have an economic mission for several centuries. It certainly had a social mission, as you know, up here in the Netherlands. For Martin Luther, the print press was like the blogosphere for the young activist today. He started mass-producing those Bibles in vernacular, and he said to his fellow Christians, you stand alone with your God, you, your Bible, the Lord, you don't need the Vatican or the priesthood. There was a Protestant Reformation. There was a Counter-Reformation. There was a 30-year war and a Peace of Westphalia. That was all social. The economic impact of the print press didn't become clear until James Watt patented the steam engine and we went to coal and steam power. In 1820s, they introduced steam technology into print. It was no longer hand-done. They put in rotary and linotype presses. They could mass-produce print really cheap. Then, around the same time, between 1830 and 1880, in the United States and Europe, we introduced public schools, mass literacy. We created a generation that was print literate so they could be the workforce to manage coal, steam, and rail, communication and energy. First Industrial Revolution. It would have been impossible to organize the complexity of coal, steam, and rail with codex in the monastery longhand. 20th century, another convergence of communication and energy, the Second Industrial Revolution. First generation communication electricity, the telegraph, more importantly, the telephone, became the management tool, and cinema, then radio and TV, the marketing communication tools to manage oil, the internal combustion engine, the interstates, suburban rollout, travel and tourism, the second industrial age. Those energies are sunsetting. The technology and infrastructure based on them are in life support this afternoon.
And I take it my way, my shiny black bits. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers. I ride and you're running, makes my guns talk the best. The rangers and deputies are hired by the rangers.
I expect you're wondering why the Jeremy Rifkin talk finished where it did. That's just a matter of time. We pretty much had the bad news now, the motivations to change. Next week we're going to conclude the talk with 35 minutes of his summary of what we should be doing about these various crises. He's going to be going into details about his vision of an empathic civilization. The media used for this show are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/509. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. If you're interested in giving feedback on the show, suggesting ideas, or otherwise making a contribution to future episodes, our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.